Okay, well, welcome again, everybody. Today, we start a two-week series on saving and investing. Today, we'll talk mostly about saving. Next week, we'll talk more about this concept of investing. And I know in a group this large, people are in completely different situations, and so some of you are saying every dollar I have is accounted for, and right now I'm in a stage of life where I honestly can't hardly save any money. Others of you are in a season of life where you have significant savings. So I hope that these lessons, some aspect of it, can be of value to you regardless of the stage of life or of the financial situation that God has allowed in your life. And as always, these topics can be sensitive to people, and so I just would remind you again that my purpose up here is not to offend any of you, and I've appreciated the opportunity to talk privately with you, some of you, as you've had concerns or issues about things that I've said or viewpoints that I've expressed, and all that is really good as we process this information together. Okay, well, let's get started then. If someone would say to you, what's the most popular verse in the Bible to encourage people to save, what would you say? Or let me put it this way, what verse is used appropriately or inappropriately to encourage people to save? Well, apparently we needed this class. Okay, let's do this another way. What animal or insect is used in the Bible as an example of savings? Yes, Nancy. The ant. Yes, yes, the ant. From Proverbs 6. Let's start there. This is a very familiar verse to all of us, verses, section of Scripture, and has been used for years to justify to people the idea that they should save. Proverbs 6, verse 6. Go to the ant, O sluggard, observe her ways and be wise, which having no chief, officer or ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provision in the harvest. Okay. So people have used those verses for years as a indication to save. And there is a sense or concept of saving in those verses. In what way? Pardon me? Okay. Mm-hmm. So, there is this sense of saving for the future. And that you take opportunity of your current abilities to save for the future. And of course, there's also the issue of work and laziness, those concepts that are very strongly a part of these verses as well. So certainly we are encouraged to save for our future, for unknown needs that come up. But as is typical of all humans who still live with sin in their lives, we continually get things out of balance. Okay, we talked about this in previous weeks. And almost anything we talk about, we can err or get out of balance with any good concept that's biblical. And what is one way that we get out of concept, or out of balance, I mean, with this concept? Okay. Yep, and we're going to look at that today. Very good, Tom, and that's in Luke 12, and we'll get there in a little bit. Okay, and that's somewhat in reference to what I was thinking of here, the concept of hoarding. So this concept was a part of my family growing up. You know, you have 12 cans of pork and beans in the cupboard, but if Giant has them on sale, you might as well buy three or four more, because you never know when you might run out of pork and beans and you might need them, okay? Or you're at the hardware store and, you know, they have cans of WD-40 on sale. And you have half a dozen cans of WD-40 already, but you never know when you're going to need more WD-40. So you might as well buy two or three more cans while you're at it, all right? Now you're all grinning at me, okay? Because you're all relating to this, okay? And I have, over the years, not just in my family, but I've had good Christian people who have justified tremendous hoarding by this verse. And I've also had people say to me, to justify this kind of a mindset, by saying, well, you know, that's just the way nature is. Just look at the squirrels. They work and work and work, and when there's a good acorn crop, they just work like crazy, bringing in as much as God gives them. So, man, I just keep growing as many potatoes in my garden as I can, because that's what... This can, so out of the chute here, let's say that savings is an issue that can easily get out of balance in our lives. Some of us don't have any savings, okay, either because God has given us little for a certain time, or because we're undisciplined in the use of our money. Others of us have savings, and that fact gets us out of balance in how we view it. So, but no doubt about it, there is a concept of saving for the future. Okay? What's another reason the Bible tells us to save? Okay, well, here it's just for the future, because we don't know what is going to happen. There's another sense of where we save. Because of planning, we have definite plans for the future, and so we need to save for them. Proverbs 21:5. If you want to turn there for a moment, Proverbs 21:5. The plans of the diligent lead to advantage, but everyone who is hasty surely comes to poverty. And the idea of this verse, or the concept of it, is the idea of savings that are built up over time for specific future plans. And that part of planning is the allocation of time and money, okay, for success into the future. So that's another way that the Bible tells us that we should save. Okay? Another reason to save is to help our giving. If you want to turn back in the New Testament to 1 Corinthians 16. Here at the end of 1 Corinthians, Paul is talking about the Corinthian churches giving a gift to the believers in Jerusalem who are so distressed. And of course, in previous weeks in this course, we looked at that same concept in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and 9. But here in chapter 16 of 1 Corinthians, verse 1 and 2, Paul's writing to these Corinthians, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, of which the Corinthian church was one, so do you also on the first day of every week, each one of you is to put aside and save, as he may prosper, so that no collections be made when I come." And what he's saying is that they are to plan ahead and save so that when he comes, they can give and contribute to the gift that goes from the Corinthian church to Jerusalem. Ultimately, in the book of Proverbs, you know that the idea is that we live a life of wisdom. And Proverbs in Proverbs 21, if you want to turn there. This is a verse where it sounds very different between different versions of the Bible. So I'll read from the New American Standard. Proverbs 21, verse 20. "There is precious treasure and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man swallows it up." And so the Bible is telling us that simply a characteristic or a definitive mark of someone who is wise is the fact that they have savings. So the Bible tells us that simply for wisdom alone, we are to have savings. There's precious treasure and oil. Okay, oil was considered a very important and precious part of life. There's precious treasure and oil in the dwelling of the wise, meaning that they don't use up every bit of resource that comes their way. Okay, so Proverbs 21:20. Encourages us simply out of a sense of living a life of wisdom to have savings. Okay, now those are biblical motivations to save. So, let's talk about reasons not to save. And some of you are saying, "Well, I love this." Reasons not to save. Reasons or motivations not to save. The first one is that you do not save out of fear. Again, we get out of balance as people of God. We know the Bible tells us we should save. But then what really motivates our saving is fear. There is a difference between worry versus planning. Some of you who tend to worry will say, "Yep, Swartz said planning is a biblical reason to save. Okay? And you just love to worry about the future and agonize and afraid of what might happen. Okay? We all are like that at times. Worry is driven by fear. Planning is driven by wisdom. Worry is driven by fear. Planning is driven by wisdom. What's motivating you? When we let fear... How do I know? How do I know whether I'm being fearful or whether I'm planning out of wisdom? Well, when we let fear control our thoughts and our actions, like saving money, okay, we won't be free to give or use our savings wisely. The fear continues to grip our life and to rule our decisions, and it keeps us from using the money then for the right reasons. So we wouldn't ever use our savings for giving because we'd never have enough. We never know what's coming. We never have enough. Okay? So when you see someone who is saving and is always afraid they never have enough, even though they have a significant amount of money saved already, it may be fear that's motivating them to save. Well, how can I... You can say, well, I still don't know, Dave. I still don't know whether I'm worrying or if I'm planning appropriately. Okay? The Bible in Proverbs talks a lot about having multiple counselors. Okay, Proverbs 15:22 talks about talking to others about your financial situation. Proverbs 24:6 does as well. Proverbs 28:26 talks about using the Bible as the whole counsel. So as a Christian, you have two things to help guide your life, and you know this. You have the Bible, and you have each other. Okay? If you're concerned about whether you have wrong motivations and stuff, talk to people in the church who you trust. Ask them what their opinion is. Okay? That's what we're here for. The beginning of Luke 12 talks about, how God has numbered the hairs on our head. We should not fear. We are more valuable than anything else, including the birds, the sparrows. Okay? So, God cares about us. We should not have fear for the future. Okay, what's another reason that people save? It's out of arrogance or pride. Okay? Because people have understood that in the world system, money means power. And money usually means position. And so if I save and get a lot of money, that means I'm going to be powerful and maybe respected. That's what they think. The Bible tells us that wealth brings a false sense of security and makes us feel confident in things that can simply disappear overnight. You want to turn to Proverbs 18? Proverbs 18 has a great section on this, starting in verse 10. Proverbs 18:10 is a familiar verse to many of you. The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run into it and is safe. And then verse 11 is the absolute contrast to verse 10. These are two verses together. Pretty cool. Verse 10, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run into it and is safe. Verse 11, a rich man's wealth is his strong city, and like a high wall in what? What's it say? In his own imagination. So there are people who save and have a lot of assets, and they're very arrogant and prideful about it, and they consider that to be their sanctuary and their safety. because whatever happens, I got it all. And as Tom said earlier in the lesson, you know, the rich, foolish guy from Luke 12 is an example of this, where he decided that he was going to build more barns. Okay? And let me just read a couple of verses of that story. I know it's familiar to you. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, "What shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops?" And then he said, "This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take ease, eat, drink, and be merry.'" What's the emphasis of that guy's thought pattern? Would you call him self-centered? Yes. You take a highlighter and just go through the I and me and mine. Okay? Very self-centered. And what's really interesting after those verses where it's all me, my, I, in verse 20, "But God said to him." If it wasn't such a sad story, it would almost be comical. He's going around, I, me, my, but God said to him. Okay. So, any of you know any multimillionaires? I know some. Do you know any? Some of you are shaking your heads, yeah. If you're around those people, they may have learned through the course of time to have a veneer of social acceptability and pleasantness and genteelness. But if you're around people like that for a while, and you get them talking in ways that reveal their mindset and their motivations, it's very, very difficult for people who have tremendous amount of assets to not be stuck on themselves and to not have arrogance and pride. Unfortunately, you know, it doesn't take, it doesn't, you can have this before you hit $3 million. You can be miserable in your attitudes and self-centered if you have $5,000 saved. Okay. But the rich think of their wealth as a strong defense, and in their imagination, it's the high wall of a city of safety. Okay, another reason not to save, and these are all related and blend together in one continuum of wrong motivations, is self-centeredness and greed. Proverbs 1:19 says, "Such is the fate of all who are greedy for money. It robs them of life." Man, have we seen that played out in people's lives? People who are just after every penny, oftentimes they lead very, not just Spartan lives, but lives that are really devoid of life. They don't have friends because that would cost money. They don't do much with their family because that would cost money. Proverbs 23:4 says, "Don't wear yourself out trying to get rich. Be wise enough to know when to quit." And so, these are reasons not to save. So most often in our materialistic society, we're on this side of the ledger, and we are trying to motivate people to plan a little bit for the future, because we see so much in our society that doesn't do this, that isn't living by wisdom. They're not really planning for the future, for specific events, and obviously they're not in a position to give anything. But certainly among us, there are people that God has blessed, or we get out of balance, as I've said before, and we walk over into these wrong motivations. I've been on that side of the ledger in my life before, okay, and probably you have been as well. Been fearful about the future, okay, not trusting in God as I should. Well, as we finish off this morning, this sort of general look at savings and how we handle money, there's a guy in the Bible that I wanted to look at for a few moments, very instructive, and that is Joseph in the Old Testament. And so the question is, looking at this, okay, how do I not become arrogant and prideful about my possessions, regardless of the level of them? Whether I'm in control, whether God has given me control of multi-millions of dollars, or, you know, with I've got $12,000 to my name. How do I keep from being arrogant? How do I not forget about God when I get to a stage of life where I have a fair amount of possessions and I'm comfortable? How do I keep from moving into that area of self-centeredness and pride where I think I've got my own walled city and I don't need God anymore? Or how do I not worry and continue to serve? Okay. Because worry is ultimately a major form of self-centeredness. Well, let's look at this guy, Joseph, in the Bible, who had it all and maintained the right perspective. You know, there's very few people in the Bible other than Joseph and Daniel where there is never a bad thing said about them. Now, how old was Joseph? Some of you who were in Steve Kowaleski's class here recently, you probably remembered this. How old was Joseph when he was handed the reins of power to become prime minister of Egypt? How old was he? 30 years old. Okay? He was 17 when he was sold by his brothers into slavery. He spent 13 miserable years in Egypt. And at the end of those 13 years, he's promoted to prime minister. Egypt is the superpower of the world at that time. So this would be the same as if a 30-year-old became president of the United States or of China. Okay? This is incredible. That a 30-year-old, I can say it now as old as I am, a 30-year-old kid becomes head of a world superpower. Okay. Wow. Okay, let's start our little cursory look at this in Genesis 41. You know, I didn't clean my Bible out and I have too much stuff. Genesis 41. Genesis 41:40, you shall be, this is Pharaoh talking to Joseph, you shall be over my house, and according to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne I will be greater than you. Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the lands of Egypt. Pharaoh took off his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, clothed him in garments of fine linen, had him ride in his second chariot, and proclaimed before him, bow the knee, and he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, though I am Pharaoh, yet without your permission, no one shall raise his hand or foot in all of Egypt. And Joseph and Pharaoh named Joseph Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him Ashenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, as his wife. And Joseph went forth over the land of Egypt. That's what you call being handed the keys to the kingdom. Talk about position and power. And with that position and power came money. Joseph had it all. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Okay, in verse 46. And so he gathered all the food during the 7 years of plenty. Okay, verse 50. Very important that we start here. Now before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph. So now, Joseph had been in this unequaled position of power and authority and position and money for 6 years. Okay, he's had a 30-year-old. He's had 6 years. So at age 36, he has his first two kids. And look what he names them. Joseph named the firstborn Manasseh, which means forget, and he named the second one Ephraim, which means fruitful. And why does he name them so? Verse 51 and 52. What's his motivation for naming his kids forgetful and fruitful? Because of God. All right, now get that. 30-year-old guy in this unequaled position as head of a superpower, functional head, the prime minister of the superpower of the world. He's in that position for 6 years. He has his first two kids, and he names them based on God. So in those 6 years in that position, it has not turned his head or his heart. Because he's still naming his kids based on what God has done in his life. Isn't that interesting? So far, all of that wealth has not turned his head or his heart. Now, the challenge for you is, and I know that for all of us it's unimaginable, if you were put in such a position of prestige of power, would it turn your head or your heart? And we see this, and we are so disappointed by it in all of our politicians. We get a local guy who has it all together. He's got what we think is the right view. We elect him to go to Harrisburg to sit in the Senate or the House of Representatives. In the scale of the world, that's not a very big deal. Okay? But they go down there, and within 2 or 3 years, they're arrogant. They're prideful. They demand respect. And you say, what happened to you? The opportunity for wealth, the position, and the power have turned their head and their heart. Even in such a little thing as serving in Harrisburg. Okay? And we continually see this. And here Joseph is head of the world superpower, and it doesn't turn his head or his heart. Naming his children showed that God was still central to his worldview. And when he reveals himself to his brothers in Genesis 45, Joseph attributes all of his life, even the bad stuff, to God's providence. He has no bitterness. You know, he literally had his brothers in the palm of his hand. He could have snuffed them out like a fly at that point. And no one, he was above reproach. No one would have asked him a question. He had that much power. And yet he says to them, God allowed this for this reason. So even when his brothers come down, he still has God as the primary thing in his head and his heart. And now we finish up with the second part of chapter 47. This is a really interesting chapter and one that people avoid like the plague, no pun intended. The second half of chapter 47 actually was not even put in some printings of Bibles in the late 1800s because it so offended the American sensibilities of free enterprise. Okay? But let's read it. Starting in verse 20 of Genesis 47. Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, and every Egyptian sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. Thus the land became Pharaoh's, and as for the people, he removed them to the cities from one end of Egypt's borders to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had an allotment from Pharaoh, and they lived off the allotment which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore they did not sell their land. Then Joseph said to the people, Behold, I have today bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here is seed for you, and you may sow the land. At the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and four-fifths shall be your own for seed of the field, and for your food, and for those of your households, and as food for your little ones. Now, this offends Americans because we have this concept of private property, and so this section is a challenge for us. But in reality, what Joseph's doing here is setting up a system much like we saw throughout Europe in the Middle Ages, where there was this feudal system and people worked for the reigning power structure in that area. But maybe this section isn't quite as offensive as what we think, because how many of you would like a 20% flat tax? Yeah, that'd be okay, I think. We might be further ahead. And that's basically what Joseph said. Hey, you give me 20%, you keep the rest. Okay? How many rulers down through human history had absolute power over those who they rule, and did not enrich themselves at the expense of their people? And yet, look at the lack of resentment among the Egyptians in verse 25. You know how people are. They will grumble about anything. Okay? Anytime you have ever stepped up to do anything, whether it's to help with the community softball league or work in the fire company or help in church, you know that eventually someone will grumble about what decisions are being made or how things are operating. And if you're doing really good, people won't say anything. That's just people. Okay? That's just people. But look at this in verse 25. The Egyptians said to Joseph, You have saved our lives. Wow. Joseph trusted God throughout this whole time, even to the end. In Genesis 50, we won't look there because of time, but even at the end of his life, as he's about to die, what he's talking to his descendants about is God. After he has lived this unfathomable life in this position of power and prestige and wealth. And the point is, how do we avoid this? How do we avoid these kind of motivations? And the answer to that is, when you look at Joseph, what you see is this continuum. He started with God and that developed his character. And from that character, then, when placed in unexpected positions of power and leadership, there was a proper execution and view of riches and power or position. So how do we avoid fear? How do we avoid arrogance and pride? How do we avoid self-centeredness? Well, when you look at the example of Joseph from the Bible, this is how it works. Okay? So are you really consumed by worry and paralyzed by it? Do you know honestly inside yourself that you're full of self-centeredness and every decision you make about money as far as savings is not made about this, but it's made out of, I'm worried about the future and I'm going to be prepared in my own city walls for whatever happens. Okay? If you honestly are evaluating yourself and that's motivating you, then go back to the character of Joseph and read that carefully and start honestly confessing it before God and say, hey, I want to be like Joseph. Regardless of where you put me, God, I want to have the right motivations so that my life is a testimony to you. Even if someday you bless me with multiple millions of dollars, it won't turn my head and it won't turn my heart. That's where we need to be. Comments or questions? Good brother. All right. Well, next week. Yes, sure. Okay. No, that obviously can't be what it means, right, Cheryl? Because he, right. Okay. All right. Tell us again what verse you're at so we can all go there. Okay, we're at Genesis 41, verse 50. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, verse 50 and 51. Now, before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph, whom Aseneth, the daughter of Potipherah, priest of On. You just wanted me to read those again. Bore to him. Joseph named the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. And he named the second Ephraim, for he said, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. What's in view there is the centrality of God to his life. And when he said, God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household, what he's talking about, honestly, is a sense of forgiveness. Not that he has forgotten about Jacob or Benjamin or any of those people. He hasn't forgotten about his people, and that's obvious because when they come to Egypt, you see how much love he has for them. Basically, what it's saying is God has allowed me to forget all that hurt and bitterness of the past. That's what it means. Other comments or questions? All right. Oh, yes, Steve. Oh, yeah. Yes. Right. Yep. Excellent point. Yep. Tom.
Is that his wife is the daughter of the main religious figure
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's an excellent point, Tom. One I was thinking of as I was reading this too, and comparing it to Solomon. Solomon was also had this unrivaled position of power and wealth, and yet he allowed women with false views of God to influence him, and Joseph did not. Excellent point. Yep. Okay, anything else? All right, we'll see you next week for a session on investing. Let's close in prayer.